Hey guys, welcome to episode 252 of the podcast with my boy of summer, the wonderful Travis McElroy. I hope you enjoyed the episode. I just want to quickly shout out Megan and Wendy for your emails, and I haven't gotten back to you yet, but I wanted you to rest assured I read and enjoyed them. And on Facebook, I wanted to thank Kevin, Jesse, Todd, and Claire. What else do I want to tell you? Listen, if you're listening to this on Thursday and you are in San Francisco, I will be up in San Francisco for Outside Lands, but on Thursday evening, I will be at a really cool local showcase that SF Sketchfest has started doing at Doc's Lab. It's going to be our inaugural event. And if you're looking for something fun to do, it's at Doc's Lab at 8. It's not expensive. And I'm just going to be there watching some great SF comedy. So come say hi. And then I will be up in San Francisco again. I think I mentioned this before, but up in San Francisco for the 26th of August, where I will be producing a day of stuff at the Castro Theater, including Doug Benson's movie Interruption with 50 Shades Darker and the West Wing Weekly, which that one actually has sold out. But it's going to be awesome. So anyway, hope to see some of you in SF or in Atlanta at Dragon Con. And I think that's just about enough ado for anyone. So please enjoy this episode with Travis. I'll talk to you next time.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
There. Listen, I'm not even going to pretend like we are in the same place because I wouldn't want to spread that sort of mistruth, that untruth out into the universe. Tell us where you are and how the weather is.
Well, I'm sitting at my desk in my attic office in Cincinnati, Ohio. The weather, thank you for asking, is lovely. It is about like 65, 70 degrees.
That is lovely.
A nice breeze. I was just sitting on the porch having afternoon tea with my wife and my friend and our baby. It was my wife and I's baby, not my friend and I's baby. And just having some tea and eating some cookies. It was great.
All right. I need a descriptor, at least one of the tea. It could be type, perfect. Flavor, pungency, and the cookies.
The tea was Moroccan mint. With one scoop of sugar, one small spoonful of sugar.
Let me stop you right there. Is Moroccan mint the kind that has caffeine?
Yeah, it's a green tea. Okay. Yeah, it's a little cat, not as caffeinated as like a black tea. I love caffeine, and so like I love teas and coffee and that kind of thing. I have different forms, different levels of caffeine depending on what time of day it is, and if I want to sleep that evening or not.
So you have the sort of standard relationship with caffeine where you get that kind of good, juicy energy from getting started with like a cup of coffee or something. And then you sort of have a sense of how it's going to play out through the day. Like what amount, like this is the kind of tea I can have at X time.
Yes.
It's very scientific.
Well, and here's the thing. Here's the reason for that. So I have ADD. And for whatever reason, the chemical makeup of an ADD brain, caffeine can react differently to it. So like,
thank you, because listen to this. The reason I asked all of this is because I also do, and my relationship with caffeine is it makes me tired.
See, for me, it's a little bit of self-medicating because caffeine doesn't make me like shaky, you know, jolty. It makes me like leveled out, like I can focus and like...
Understood.
It lowers my racing brain. But then if I have it too close to bedtime, my brain already races. Like I already have a hard time falling asleep because I just lay there and think about like all the stuff I didn't get done and all the stuff I have to do tomorrow. And so a little bit of extra caffeine in there is like, and now also you're afraid of the apocalypse and vampires and death and stuff.
That's right. I can definitely relate to that. But again, other than the fact that for some reason, like I don't enjoy any positive benefits really of caffeine, but I do like the taste of things that have caffeine in them. So it's for me, it's sort of the dance of like, I have to be careful not to have too much
like black tea at once, or and I can't drink coffee at all, because it either it will make me really tired, or it will make me feel like I've taken like cold medicine that is supposed to pep you up, but instead makes you feel like everything is a fog, but also your heart's kind of racing. Like you want to lie down and go to sleep, but you also feel like your heart's going to explode. So there's no like moment where I'm like, God, this is great. I just feel so peppy. I don't ever quite get there with caffeine.
For me, it's a preventative measure because I've been drinking coffee so long at this point. And it's like, I like routine. I like having like, I wake up in the morning, have two cups of coffee. And like, that's as I sit there and check the news. And like, now as I'm like sitting with the baby and like have a morning check-in before I start work. If I don't have caffeine now, I develop a massive headache about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Because like now I'm my body is like, wait, where's our
coffee?
We
need this to live.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Wendy, do you remember when you started drinking coffee? Were you someone who got an early kind of taste for it? Because, you know, I remember sitting through like smoking cigarettes at Denny's and sitting through cups of coffee as a goth teenager, not because I particularly liked the taste, but because it like felt like it went along with what I was trying to be.
Yeah, I got into it when I was about like 16 drinking coffee because for me it just seemed so adult. Like it seemed so like and I this is dumb, but I am also a huge like sci-fi fantasy nerd, and like coffee is like a potion. It's I like a thing that has benefits and like actual effects that feels like a magic potion. And so like I was drawn to this idea of like drinking this alters something about it. Felt like magic to me when I was like 16. And so for me it wasn't in any way a rebellious thing. Like I remember the first time I think I really enjoyed a coffee was I was in New York with my parents on like a family vacation. And we went somewhere where they had like really nice cheesecake, and like you can't stop me from eating cheesecake. And I ordered a cup of coffee with my cheesecake, and like my parents just found it so funny and charming that like their 16-year-old son was sitting there sipping on a coffee and cheesecake, and I just loved it.
there's so many tangents I feel like I want to go off on that, but I'm going to stick to my original thought, which was, did that hold true for other body chemistry altering substances? Like, did you have an awareness of like pot in that way, or alcohol, or anything else that's like has a stronger effect?
Alcohol, definitely. Like it never in any way that was a problem, but like my college years, I never really partied in high school, mostly because I was just like, as much as I was an asshole when I was in high school, but I was still like a really good kid who like I had like a really overdeveloped sense of like honor and guilt and everything. So like I hated getting in trouble because it just made me feel like such a small, like little insignificant, you know, worm to have to be like, I messed up, I'm so sorry. And so like I never really partied, but in college, like my friends and I, we partied like 5 nights a week. Like we had events Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday night. And so like we were, you know, destroying a house, you know, drinking and driving reckless kind of thing, but just like very social college experience in a way that I just didn't really have in high school. As far as drugs go, like never really got past weed, really. Like I think because of a rare spike of like self-awareness, I could feel that I have a very like addictive, I get into things, like I binge on stuff really hard. And like there was just something where I knew, like, if you ever experiment with harder drugs, like you're not coming back. Like you're not going to be able to control yourself. You can barely control yourself when it comes to like eating cheesecake and fried chicken and beer. Like you're not going to be able to control yourself if you ever got into like coke or heroin or whatever. So I just never really got past pot. And even then I wasn't super into it because I just don't react well to it. Like it makes me really paranoid and out of control in a way that I just don't like. So like just personal preference, I don't really I don't really do the marijuana, as the kids say.
Well, listen, I can also relate strongly to that. Although these guys know, when I was a high school student, I definitely smoked a lot of pot, and it actually was like mostly fine and great. But I, when I say I smoked a lot of pot, like, I definitely wasn't a person who smoked every day. I mean, mm-hmm. to me, that's like every couple of months I would get really high. You know what I mean? It was still not like that often of a thing. And then in college, I smoked it after a weird, almost near-death experience where I was like in a back of a truck that started sliding down a mountainside in the snow.
Oh, no.
And yeah, it was very strange. And I'm assuming, I'm sort of making that connection, because that was the first time after that I smoked pot and I had this horrible out-of-body experience. And so I haven't, and then I tried a couple more times, like after that, you know, as you do, if you have a habit that you thought was fine, mm-hmm. And the same thing would happen. So I hadn't, like, I haven't been stoned since I was 18 years old. And the only thing that has changed for me in the last couple of years is just this, like, I'm just like sort of dipping a toe into the idea that the pot that I was smoking back then is so wildly different from what has been cultivated to now, that I'm kind of like, you know what? Maybe there's a strain. I certainly don't want to take any chances and just like start, you know, tugging on some unknown product. Mm-hmm. But maybe there's a way to like dip a toe in something that would not create that kind of paranoia. Up to this point, it just hasn't even been worth it. It's just been like, I don't even want to, like, that's just not important enough for me to take those risks.
Well, I also realized recently, like, the way that I was enjoying pot, that I was imbibing pot, was also the equivalent of like going to a bar and taking shots. Like, it was like bong rips and shit. So,
right,
like,
right.
Yeah. So, like, living in LA where, you know, medicinal marijuana was legal, I got some for insomnia and was just doing like edibles, which is a very, for me at least, like, fairly gentle way of like enjoying it. That it was like, oh, this experience. It was the difference between taking shots and like sipping a glass of scotch. You know what I mean? So it's
exactly.
Like, oh, okay. I was doing it bad. I was like,
right.
I was either zero or super stoned without ever like scaling that in any way. But just for me, like, I whenever I would get stoned, I felt so out of control. And I have, like, I love being in control both of myself and of life in general.
Me too.
That feeling of like, I can't pull it together. I'm tugging at the strings trying to get myself back in line and I can't do it. I hate it so much.
Yeah. I could not relate more. I don't think that it passed me by that you said that you were a good kid, but who was also an asshole. So
such
I need
an
to
asshole.
Explore what made you an asshole in high school.
So remember how I mentioned the control thing? I was a drama kid who, like, I was the lead in all the shows, and I was in show choir. And, like, also, like, I've been trying for, like, the last couple years to remember high school clearer. Because the way my memory, I don't have a great memory in general. I remember stories instead of, like, actual events. So I can tell stories all day long about stuff that happened. But if you're like, yeah, but did you ever get bullied? I can't remember. Did you, what teachers did you like? I don't know. What was, you know, what classes did you take? I have no idea. But, like, I was a drama kid, and so my sophomore year, we got a new drama teacher who was just completely unqualified for the job. She had been, like, an elementary school teacher who had never worked in drama in any form, never taught it, but because of the way that our county worked, I grew up in Huntington, West Virginia. The way that the county worked was all based on seniority. And because she had been working in the county so long, she got the job over far more qualified people that I knew were applying from, like, one county over.
Wait a minute. I feel like you already have a stronger sense of, like, what's going on in the bureaucracy of the educational system as a young person than I ever would have. Did you really know, like, at the time, as a teenager, that there were that this all the stuff was kind of in place, and that's how she got the job, and other people, like, was that information that you rooted out because she was so bad?
Well, yeah. So basically, it was that job? Where, like, I'm very nosy, And it took, so our drama teacher retired.
I love that you're like, I got to get to the bottom of this.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a boy detective. I love Encyclopedia Brown. Grew up reading Encyclopedia Brown. Boy detective
me
all the way.
Me too. God, me too.
And so our previous drama teacher retired at the beginning of the school year. And she, I won't say her name because it'll be obvious in a second. Drama teacher two came in after like the start of the second semester. So for the entire first semester, we just had like a string of substitutes. So like the whole time I was like, why, what's going on? Why is this taking so long? And so like, I was asking my parents and I was talking to other teachers in the school. And like, I was very close with a lot of teachers, like, what's the deal? Why don't we have a new drama teacher yet? And they were explaining to me like why the hiring process was so messed up in the county. And so she started and she had like no idea what she was doing. And I was like in the highest level drama class the school offered. And she had us like cutting out like, you know, paper masks, like the drama, you know, tragedy, comedy mask, and talking about what drama meant to us. And it's like, are we going to like do scenes or work on acting?
Yeah.
And so one day she kind of blew up at me and she said, you don't respect me. And I said, respect is earned and not given. And she started crying and shut herself in her office. And after that, I basically ran the class and like I would assign homework and I picked out scenes for everybody to do and like decided what projects we were going to work on. And like I told the teacher what play we were going to do for the fall and spring musicals and
wow.
Yeah, I just kind of like wrestle, which here's the thing, I want to be clear. I'm telling this story now. At the time I was like, yeah, I'm Spartacus. But now I'm like, I was an asshole. Like there was so much nicer ways like, I could have done that.
Well, yeah. But the kids obviously embraced that. So it's like, you know, it's not, you were the sort of Spartacus. Like they reinforced the idea that you had saved this entire semester or year or whatever from, you know, being a complete disaster of not getting to do anything and not really feeling like you. But yeah, I mean, if she cried and locked herself in her office, yeah, that was definitely another, intense.
There was another like time we were doing Footloose and I was playing Rin, which is, you know, Kevin Bacon part, and
but like Footloose was a play or you adapted it into a
no
play?
The musical, there's a musical Footloose, it's really good.
Oh, I didn't
actually
know that.
Yeah, a lot of fun.
I didn't know that.
And I played Rin and we had like five different directors. We had like the director and then the choreographer and then the choir, you know, like the music director, and then like the woman who was directing the orchestra. And so it was like they were all kind of like trying to give simultaneous but conflicting notes. And so it ended up the rehearsal took way longer than it should. And they were trying to do two runs of the show in the rehearsal. And so they just told us we were going to skip dinner break to get the second one in. And they were like, just go grab something. This is not a joke. This is adults saying to like 14, 15, like, just go grab something out of the vending machine. And in 10 minutes, we'll do the run again. And I said, well, I'm going to go have dinner and I'm in every scene. So good luck rehearsing without me. And I walked out. And then apparently I was told later that then the director said, well, that's dinner. Everybody come back in an hour. Which here's the thing. At the time, I was like, yeah, can't stop me. I'm literal Ren McCormick. I'm leading the kids. But now, as an adult, I'm like, I was insufferable. Like, yes, but also these were my teachers, and I was like 16, 17 years old, like running my mouth to adults. Like, if I met that kid now, I would not take shit from him. Like, that kid would, right. I would not be like, yeah, you get him, kid. I would be like, who the fuck is this asshole? Who let this get in here?
There's also like, it's what's interesting about it too is like, I'm trying to think if there was anybody who had that kind of dynamic that I went to school with. And I think the reality is like, what's conjuring for me is it's because in my mind I was like, well, I'm sure the adults just didn't know what to do with that. So they sort of, you broke them, you broke their robot adult brains. But because I think they're probably used to people who are totally absent to the idea of being students for one reason or another. And so they're shitty to their teachers because they don't want to be there at all, or, you know, they're just angry people in general, but they're also not applying themselves. But then, or you want to be good and you want to be doing the, you know, the actual work in the theater class, and you're a good kid and you're a kiss ass, or, you know, you're just sort of like magnanimous with everybody, including the teacher, and deferential. The idea that you would be like passionate and having the conviction to do and be present to the class and actually wanting to get more out of the class, but also being a dick to the teachers, I bet was so confusing to them. What is this? What is this? What species of kid is this?
Well, because that's the thing, is I was super engaged. Like, I loved school, and like I had a great, like, my speech and debate teacher, Miss Lynn, I loved her. Like, we got on great. I wanted her to be the drama teacher because she had taught drama previously at a different school, but she was happy being the speech and debate teacher. Like, she and I got along wonderfully. And, like, in fact, I only did speech and debate because I liked her so much. And, like, I had history teachers and English teachers that I just adored, science teachers that I adored. But when it came down to it, like, the class I cared most about was drama, and the worst teacher I had was my drama teacher. And so, like, I just felt so let down by her that I just reacted so poorly to her. And like I said, it's, you know, if I could do it all over again, I would have, and I'd do it differently. Uh-huh. But like at the time, it did kind of, like, the thing is like, I don't regret saying something, and I don't regret taking on kind of a de facto leadership role. I just wish I had worked with her rather than be like, step out of the way and let me do it. You know what I mean? That's what I would do differently now. Right. Of like, well, let's work together. I have some ideas about what we could do, rather than just like, I got this, go sit in your office. Right. I'll give notes. Like, I gave notes during class. Like, I like, yeah, it was not great. Like, and like, I didn't have that relationship. I had choir teachers too that I got along with great. So it wasn't just like a performing thing. It was just this one teacher, and I did not click.
And what was there any? There was no kind of competition among any other student who was sort of like miffed that you took on that role. There wasn't anybody else who also was passionate about it, who was like, "Well, now hold on, I also would like to give some notes."
No, because especially in high school. I'm going to try. So I'm also like a narcissist, a recovering narcissist, that I'm going to try not to be all braggadocious and talk about how great I was in high school, because I'm really trying to make it clear that I was a jerk. But I'm also very charming. And like, so people liked me a lot. And like, so I think everyone in the drama department, like, I was friends with. I had a lot of friends in the drama department. And I was also like, I grew up doing theater from like the age of like 6. And did community theater, school theater. I, like, my family was very active in church, and my parents started a drama program in the church. So, like, I did theater at church. I did some shows with the local college, Marshall University. And, like, so I, as far as, like, what, a 17, 18-year-old kid, I knew more than most. So, like,
yeah.
I think that there's easily could have been a situation in which I was trying to do that, but I had no idea what I was talking about. But like, also in Huntington, West Virginia, it's not like it was a arts, you know, destination school. So like,
I don't know. Your description of the rehearsal of Footloose sounds super intense.
Yeah. I mean, well, the school system was very interesting in Huntington. I know I said I don't have a good memory, and now I'm giving you all the details about how the county worked. But originally there had been all these smaller high schools that over like a decade, they just kept consolidating schools until eventually we just had this one like massive high school that had like 2,200 kids in it. And so like, we ended up with really great facilities, like really great programs, because just there was only one high school that they were funneling all the funding to. So we ended up with fairly good resources. And we, by no means, there was a school one county over called Capital in Charleston that was like, had an amazing theater program that did like 6 shows a year for a high school. Like, they were incredible. They were like the one, and their teacher had applied for the job in Huntington at the Huntington High drama department, and she hadn't gotten it. And I had worked with her in summer theater. And so that was another reason I knew so much about it, because I talked to her like, hey, what? Why didn't you get the job? I know you applied. And she explained the whole situation to me. And so, like, and I think I was also kind of like, I had a little bit, I think, of animosity because I knew there was this teacher that could have given me like 2 years of really solid, intense theater training who didn't get the job. And instead, this other person who wasn't bringing anything to the table got the job. And so I think I was very resentful of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that totally makes sense. Well, where's the rest of your family figure in? Were your brothers into, were you guys in similar classes? Like, were they into drama too? You said that.
Oh, yeah. We all grew up doing it.
They developed drama club.
We were a theater family, grew up doing it.
Were you? I don't know the age difference between you guys. So I don't know if, like, obviously it doesn't sound like one of your brothers was in that class that you took over.
Oh, God. If my older brother had been in that class, he would have really sat on me, maybe literally, to be like, hey, stop being an asshole. My older brother is 3 years older than me, and my little brother is 3 years younger than me. So,
oh, okay. Yeah.
So we had a pretty good spread.
Like, just escape being,
I overlapped, you know, senior and freshman year with my older brother, and then my little brother the other way around.
Exactly. And that was because that was the other question I was going to ask, like, based on everything you were talking about, kind of assuming those leadership roles at school, was how that played out in your family, if it was like an entirely different dynamic at home.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, is like, what it came down to is, I think I had a really, I didn't see the dynamic of like teacher, student, adult, kid. I was just like, I am also a human being in this room with you.
And so
like, it all came down to respect for me without just giving because you're the teacher and I'm the student. And so like at home, I couldn't have respected my parents more. And so like, I was not rebellious to my parents. You know, little things like, you know, saying, oh, yeah, his mom's totally going to be there. It's not just a sleepover without any parental supervision. But like,
right.
I wasn't sneaking out. I came home drunk once when I was 16 and felt so guilty. Like, I didn't drink again until college. Because my parents just sat there going, what did we do wrong? And I was like, you didn't do it. You're great.
Yeah.
My favorite part about that story, though, is I came home late, drunk. Way past my curfew, and my mom was like sitting in a dark room, and when I walked in, she turned on the lamp and like I fell over. She scared the shit out of me, and she was like, it's way
really
past
that's
curfew.
Very cinematic.
And I was like, oh yeah, I got caught up in a movie. We started a movie and I didn't see the time. And she was like, what movie? And for some reason, the only movie that popped in my head was Stuart Little 2. I was like, Stuart Little too. Like, what kind of cool party were you at, Travis, that went till like 2 o'clock in the morning and you guys were watching Stuart Little too?
Do you think that, and did it from that point be eventually you had to admit to her that you were drunk because she could like how long did, that lie did
5 minutes
any further than the front
maybe
door?
No, we passed each other in a hallway as I went upstairs and she went, you smell like beer. And I was like, okay, yep. Mm-hmm. Deaf. Yeah, totally.
You got me.
Yep. Nailed it.
And so within the popularity of, you know, being well liked and all that in high school, did that confidence also extend to crushes, relationships, like dating, that kind of thing?
The thing is, for a long time, my dating MO was like much like what I loved in the hobby. I loved drama. I loved, like, you know, anybody who was hard to get. And like, I had to work, like, I had a girlfriend my entire senior year, and it took me like 3 months to convince her to date me, because we had dated briefly before that and broken up. And like, she was like, well, it didn't work out that time. And I was like, no. And as soon as she was like, no, I'm not interested, that was like, I shall win your heart. And like, I spent like, you know, writing letters and like, I have to tell you. And then like one day, finally, I looked at her and was like, okay, we've been talking about this for a long. And I should say, like, she was not completely spurning my advances. Hers was just like, I don't know, we tried it before, I'm not sure. And so finally I was like, I just would like to know yes or no? And she said no. And I said, okay. And I went home. And then the next day she knocked on my door crying. I was like, I made a huge mistake. I want to date you. And then we dated for like a year.
Wow. A year is forever in high school, by the way.
Yeah, so my entire senior year dated. She was a junior when I was a senior. And she was great. And once again, I didn't like treat her badly or anything, but I think I didn't appreciate like, here's this separate person from me who lives their own life and has their own wants and desires and doesn't just exist when you can see them and doesn't disappear when they're not in the room. And so like,
does this yeah, go ahead.
Well, and so then I started like looking at colleges and I ended up going to the University of Oklahoma, and it was really upsetting to her that like I was leaving town, and like I just couldn't understand why she was so upset about this thing. Like, it's gonna be fine, I'll come back and we'll do long distance, it'll be great. And like, she was very upset at the idea of like me leaving town. And like, I just, in once again, another thing that I look back in retrospect and like, I remember thinking like, I'm the victim here, she's so upset, why is she freaking out? And now I look back on, I'm like, you could have handled that so much better. Like, I was just so self-centered that I couldn't understand why she would be upset about this great thing that was happening to me.
But yeah, I mean, you obviously you mentioned that you're a recovering narcissist, so I wanted, but like, you also had tremendous respect for your parents, as you said, and that you did have this feeling that you didn't want to, you know, let them down, and you did have this sort of feeling of guilt and this kind of sense of honor in that way. When did you decide to recover from being a narcissist, and when did you name yourself that, and how serious are you when you use that term? Are you just a sweet person who now feels like maybe you were a jerk when you were younger?
All good questions. So,
and possibly deliver too many at once. But
no, I think I can tick them off. Far as when I realized, my brother Justin and my sister-in-law Sydney, who I've known basically my whole life, grew up doing theater together. They sat me down at dinner one night when I was about like 23, and they were just like, "Hey, I was kind of dating, but never like hadn't found a relationship." And I did that a lot, where like I would spend like 2 weeks more or less dating somebody, and then it would just kind of fizzle out because I was so self-centered that I was just not good at taking the other person's desires and thoughts. I talked so much about myself. I never asked questions. I never got interested in the other person. I just wanted them to be interested in me. And so my brother and my sister kind of pointed that out to me, and I kind of started working on it then. I also had this wonderful human being, one of my best friends named Michael Bradbury, who one night after a party, I was hanging out with him, you know, helping him clean up. And he was like, "Hey, just so you know, all my friends think you're an asshole." And I was like, "What? Shit. I thought they were my friends too." And he's like, "Well, once they get to know you, they like you. But when they first meet you, you kind of make kind of snarky jokes and you talk about yourself a lot. And I know that's not really you, but that's kind of the first impression you give to people." Mm-hmm. And it was just like this intervention moment of like, oh, because like I just moved back home and I didn't have a lot of friends. I had not had like carryover friends. So it was like I was back in my hometown, but all of my friends had like gone away to college and moved away. And so, like, I was making new friends mostly through Bradbury. And so finding out that, like, these people who I was considering my new friend group, it was hard for them to see me as a good person, was, like, a gut punch. And so,
of course.
Yeah. So I kind of started working on that. And then the biggest thing that happened was I met my now wife. So when I was 25, I started dating my wife. So that was about 9 years ago. And she has been a wonderful influence. She's one of the few people that I, honest to God, no joke, love more than myself. And so, like, her wants and needs became more important to me than my own, which was, like, a weird feeling. And it was one of those things, like, as soon as I realized that, it was easy for me to see how bad I had been about doing that for other people, where, like, rather than ask someone, like, "Where would you like to go to dinner?" I would just say, like, "This is where we're going to dinner." Or if I wanted to watch a movie, I would just put the movie in without asking. I mean, it was like, I hadn't known I was doing it. I wasn't aware that I didn't let other people talk and that I didn't ask questions and that I wasn't really interested in other people's lives so much as I was interested in telling them about mine. That yeah. I like, not only that, I also, so when I say I'm a narcissist, like I've talked to my therapist about it. And you know, it's not like she has ever looked at me and said, yep, narcissist. But like I tick off, or I used to, I'm trying not to now, but all of these boxes about like, you know, delusions of grandeur. Like, for example, one of the things that I'm now aware of and I try not to do anymore, but like I would see someone playing guitar and I would think, I bet I could do that. Even though I've never practiced guitar, I've never picked up a guitar, I've never learned it, but I was just overwhelmed by this feeling of like, I could be better than that person at that if I tried. And like that was my first response to seeing, like I would see someone paint or, you know, sing a song. And all I would think was like, yeah, I could be better than them. Or like I would think
Isn't
about
that
myself.
Fascinating.
Yeah. And that was like my go-to, or like when I thought about myself as being successful when I was like 18, it wasn't a question of like, would I be successful at something? Would I become well-known for something? I was going to. And anybody who told me differently, I would be like, you're wrong. I'm great and I'm inherently great. So I didn't do a lot of like work to improve myself, but I was pretty inherently great. I was a National Merit Scholar. You know, I was lead in a lot of shows in high school. And then I got to college and nobody knew me. And like there was nobody from West Virginia there. So I like didn't have any prior relationships to fall back on, any established stuff to fall back on. I wasn't getting the lead in shows for the first couple years. And like I suddenly had to rebuild. So that's when I kind of started being a lot more snarky and sarcastic as like, I'm super cool, dude. Rather than just like bold and brassy, I was also being kind of a shithead. and so, yeah, I'm completely legit, meaning completely seriously when I say I was a narcissist. I don't think I was ever a bad person. I was never like a sociopath or like, you know, I was never like, I'm going to embezzle everybody's money because I'm so important and so great. But it was just more like I was so bad at caring about other people in a sincere way. Like I loved my friends and I loved, you know, people, but the idea of like, yes, but I still want to do what I want to do though. So let's do what I want to do first. And then we could talk about doing what you want to do. and like, I didn't see anything wrong with that. Like I thought that was, I mean, to tie this all back together, I saw that as like, I'm a born leader because I was always the one making the plans and telling people what we were going to do and all of that. And I didn't see anything wrong with it until, mostly until I was like 25. And my wife would be like, hey, like she would just kind of lay a hand on my arm and she's like, just so you know, in that entire like 20-minute conversation we just had with our friends, you basically just dictated to them rather than like asking them questions or seeing what they wanted to. You just kind of said like, hey, tomorrow, let's all hang out. We'll go see a movie. Then we'll grab dinner. See you guys at 4? And like never left any air for them to contribute to the plan.
Right.
And it's still something I struggle with. Like I have actively worked over the last like decade to educate myself about other people's lives that, I mean, I'm a straight white dude with no like visible disabilities from Huntington, West Virginia. So I did not grow up like exposed to other cultures, ways of life, thoughts that weren't my own. And then I went to school in Oklahoma and then I lived in Ohio. So it wasn't exactly like I was hitting big metropolitan areas where I was being exposed to new input and new stimuli. And so like I've worked really hard for the last decade or so to like ask questions of people and try to see people like see people's lives through their own eyes and that kind of thing. So that's why I say recovering, because it's something I'm still working at. And the nice thing, I tried to hold on to my very, very healthy self-confidence.
No, I mean, that's the thing, right? Is that if you can, because that's such an enviable quality for so many people, particularly like artistic and creative people, where somehow self-doubt, I don't know if it's more pervasive or people's emotions are just closer to the surface for one reason or another, or, you know, that it is like, whatever it is, it's so common among creatives. And I think that it's probably just as common among people who aren't necessarily doing something creative as a career, but are, you know, creative people or what have you. But somehow the way it's expressed in the arts, you know, it just seems like it's more pervasive on some level. So that when you have people who kind of cut through that and just seem like very confident that they're really good at it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's that weird balance to strike, right? Is that like, I think even someone has maybe someone said that about my dad once. I hope he wouldn't mind that I would say this, because I think it's germane. But I think someone said to my dad once, like, you're very full of yourself. And I don't think my dad is full of himself at all, but he is very comfortable with who he mm-hmm. is. He's also extraordinarily empathetic to other people and is sort of a bleeding heart liberal in that way. And, you know, cries at movies and that kind of stuff. But he also knows what he's good at. He doesn't think he's good at everything, but he knows that he is really good at what he's really good at, and he's very comfortable talking about it, and he's not ashamed of that, and he's not overly modest about it. Mm-hmm. But nothing about that is obnoxious to me. But I could totally see how somebody who has, you know, is more along the lines of being raised to refuse compliments at every turn, or, you know, just try to like constantly demur and be like, oh, me, oh, old me, silly old me. No, I'm not good at that. You know what I mean? Even if they're like the most brilliant at it, that kind of social construct that we're taught, like we tell kids to feel great about themselves mm-hmm. and to believe in themselves and that they can do anything. But then you get to a certain age, like when a little kid is like, I can do anything I want. We're like, you bet you can, buddy. Good work. And then if you're 25 and you're like, I'm great at everything, I can do anything I want, people are like, calm down, snob.
Yeah,
like, calm
get
down,
out of here, dude.
Arrogant. So there's that sort of weird, it's just a weird, like, kind of counterintuitive, like, wait a minute, I thought we said we wanted people to be. So I can understand so easily how, like, cultivating one part of that and not picking up on the social cues of like, oh, wait, I'm not supposed to think that, or I'm not supposed mm-hmm. to say that about myself, or I'm not, could be incredibly confusing, or just like miss someone altogether. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it, the thing is it's, the problem can be like, especially when, so for me, I think it developed from like kind of a defensive place of like championing myself and telling myself how great I was, because I was like, before you know, high school, I was so self-conscious as like a little kid. Like in second grade, the same year I got glasses, got diagnosed with ADD and started taking medication, and entered into the Talented and Gifted like accelerated learning program, and also started speech therapy. So like all in second grade. It was this roller coaster of like just basically feeling suddenly so different from everybody else. Like I was leaving class every day at noon to go take my Ritalin, and then every Friday leaving class to go to the Talented and Gifted program, every Tuesday going for like a half hour to speech therapy. And like, I'm also wearing glasses. I had a gigantic head and like a scrawny little body, and like I was just a dork, you know, and like I just felt so different, and so like if I heard people like giggling behind me, I was like, well, that's me, they're making fun of me, and I would just assume that people were making fun of me. So then as I started to get older and kind of find talents and find out what aspects of myself people liked, I cultivated those and like built confidence around them to a point where I would wear it like armor, and like this ability to, well, if this person doesn't like me, it's because of how terrible they are, and their inability to recognize my greatness is what's making them terrible, so I don't have to worry about them. And I used to.
I mean, you would be a great Scientologist. Let's just put that right out.
Or a cult leader. Oh man, I could start my own cult like that. I'd be incredible. But the problem is with that kind of armor and what you. One of the big things of narcissism is like very superficially charming, and that's what I was. Mm-hmm. I was very good at making people like me. But when it really came down to it, I wasn't really cultivating, like, deep relationships with people. I just had a lot of superficial relationships with people. So it was very easy for me to, like, date someone for, like, 2 weeks. But I wasn't really invested. I wasn't by which I mean not that I didn't like them, but that I wasn't giving actual, you know, attention. I wasn't committing anything to getting closer to them and getting to know them better. I just wanted them to like me. And then once they did, I kind of was like, okay, cool, check mark, done. And wasn't good at growing it, you know? And so...
Well, also, and I mean, having long-term... I mean, the conflict resolution is sort of like, if you have a good family dynamic, which obviously you do... With your brothers and your parents and stuff, you have kind of, I mean, I feel like baked in is a sort of conflict resolution, like gene or is certainly at least a muscle that gets exercised. Mm-hmm. Like I'm an only child and my parents never remarried. So the only thing that ever had to be resolved was like between my dad and me or between my mom and me. And I didn't really have to. And I don't come from money or anything, but I didn't ever have to, I had to be told no a ton about what I wanted and couldn't have because we couldn't afford it or because my parents were very sensible, just practical people. But I never had to like, other than with friends, like I never had to like share or, you know, this is how we're going to spend this time. So I have the kind of narcissism that comes from just being an only child, which is by virtue of just never having a family member in the house other than my parents who told me what was going to happen that I had to like work stuff out with. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Whereas you sort of have that, but in relationships, once you get past the kind of like, you know, like, as you said, when you met your wife and her needs and her interests became more important to you. It's interesting to me that, you know, in a situation where you're in love with someone or you start living with someone or whatever, that your familial background wouldn't kick in faster, because I'm sure you guys had to compromise. Like you had brothers, you didn't always get your way. As you said, you respected them. They, you know, they kind of told you what's up, or at least your older brother. And so like, you know, because I guess that's what I'm saying is like, it's interesting that you had to compromise just by virtue of being in a big family with such a close age range. But then when it came to like you going outside of your family to choose those relationships, that you were like, wait, what? No, I just know what's going to be the best for us in this situation. Like, I'm going to make sure we have a great time.
Well, I wanted an entourage is what it was. I wanted like a people who just like followed me around. And really, to give you the last big piece of the puzzle that will also click into place, and not to be too much of a bummer, but just to get real. My mom passed away when I was 21. And
I'm so sorry.
It's all right, and I'm about to explain why. So that also led me to later in like a couple years after that, getting really into like Zen and meditation and kind of figuring out a different way of looking at the world. Because basically, what happened was I think of it this way. When I was born, I started building a building, right? Building a building of my life. And had my mom never died, I think I probably would have just continued on building that building. And you would have been able to connect every action I took all the way back through the house. But when my mom died, it was like an earthquake that kind of destroyed the house that I'd been building. Which made it really hard for like 2-3 years after that. But what it did was give me this chance to, at 23, 24 years old, start a complete new building with the knowledge that I had about the person I wanted to be from that point forward instead of just having to keep building off of the building I already had. So it allowed me to kind of do this because my personality was kind of from 21 to 22, more or less blank slate, where like I just mm-hmm. was so despondent. I wanted to drop out of school before I graduated, and like my one of my favorite professors, Tom, who was my mentor in college, kind of convinced me like my mom wouldn't want me to do that, and like my dad told me the same thing, and so like I did finish school, but for that year, like I was pretty I was just going through the motions and existing, and so it kind of gave me this ability to, when I was 23, 24, start my life from a point of like, all right, who do you want to be? Who is adult Travis going to be? Because you don't just have to keep doing what you did as kid Travis and high school Travis and college Travis. Who do you want to be from this point forward? And I wanted to be somebody my mom would be proud of. And so like that's kind of where I started, where it's like, my mom was this wonderful person, church secretary, wonderful human being who was the most dependable person, the most loving mother, the most dedicated, wonderful person I've ever known in my entire life. And I wanted to be that. So that's what I started working from. That's kind of where I built from there. I feel like I'm getting so deep on this comedy podcast. I apologize.
No. I can't tell you how many people are like shaking their heads and laughing at the idea of that, because this podcast is maybe the least funny podcast in the comedy. Like you're in excellent company. You're in excellent company.
Perfect.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, obviously that when things like that happen to us when we're younger, that is the sort of silver lining, right? And I think we're entitled to see it that way and to appreciate it and respect it for what it is, because it does give us the tools, whether we asked for them or not, to do a lot of fucking work on ourselves that we would not have had to do otherwise. And hopefully, in a perfect scenario, that is leading to being able to handle the shit that gets thrown at us as adults better as well, you know?
Yeah. And like, it's so tough because it's one of those things like, would I rather still have my mom around? Yeah, of course. Of course I would. But, like, when it comes down to it, like, I am the person I am now because of everything that's come before this, not just because of, like, one moment or one thing. I am who I am with everything I've done. And, it's just one of those things where I like the person I am now way better than I liked the person I was when I was 15 or 20 or 22 or 23. I like the person I am now. And I also try to continue to grow more every day. Like I have a 9-month-old baby, and it has been one of the scariest processes of my entire life. Because when she was born, I had this moment of realization of like, well, she gets all of you now.
Uh-huh.
Of like, I don't get to dictate the plan for the day. I can't look at her and be like, hey, I need you to stop screaming because I want to sleep. Like, she doesn't care. She doesn't care. It's the most, like, immersive therapy for a narcissist of, like, you need... And that's the thing. I love my baby more than anything. And so, like, it was another kind of, like, kick in the pants of, like, hey, you need to step up to an even higher level of, not being a narcissist now. Because this person doesn't care. She's not interested in your story. She doesn't care how funny you are. You have to take care of her.
Yeah.
And so, like, that's the thing, is it became this new process of, hey, here's a fork in the road. You're either going to be a shitty dad for the rest of your life because this baby distracts from how great you are, or you realize that she is more important than you. And you're going to work on being a good dad. And so, like, that's what I've been doing for the last 9 months. And it's one of the big reasons I started going to therapy, because I was like, I'm frustrated and I shouldn't feel frustrated. this is my baby. Yeah. I love her so much. Why am I frustrated? So I started going to therapy, and my therapist was like, oh, you're frustrated because it's really frustrating. Babies are very frustrating. And I was like, okay, cool.
Yeah, that's any parent in the world would be like, buddy, I really feel your pain, and I don't even think of myself as being self-centered.
Yeah, I was just so worried because I would have these moments where I was just like, let me go to sleep. Why are you screaming? Yeah. Why won't you? And it was like, I shouldn't feel this way. I should just love her with all my heart. And so I started going to therapy, and it was like, no, that's, you're fine. But that said, I still have kept working on it because, like, I frustration is the thing. I mean, part of my ADD has always been, like, that kind of, like, obsessive worry mm-hmm. about stuff. So I get really frustrated mm-hmm. really easy, especially when it's, like, something doesn't go my way. And, like, another thing I've realized is, like, if I get mad at something I read on the internet, or if, you know, I get in a fight with somebody on Twitter, I can't sit there and yell in front of my baby. Like, my baby doesn't care that I got mad at somebody on Twitter. I'm not going to yell. Yeah. I'm not going to yell in front of her. You know what I mean? Like, she is the best deterrent for a bad mood ever.
Totally. And, like, ultimately, the good news is that you... I mean, I feel like if you set yourself up to feel amazing about being the best dad in the world and mm-hmm. being really confident and being very smug about that, like if because you understand what that actually means, that means that you are the best at giving up things about yourself to benefit your baby, and you can be like, it can just replace, like, you can still be the awesomest.
I'm the best dad.
It'll just be that you're exactly. Like, then, but it's absolutely to someone else's benefit. My baby was so born. It's great. It's the best of both worlds.
My baby ended up spending the first 10 days of her life in the NICU, in the natal intensive care unit, uh-huh. neonatal. And she was fine. She was just born a couple days shy of full term. So the first time I tried to change her diaper, she was hooked up to all these, you know, sensors and stuff. So there's all these wires running off of her. And, like, I was so afraid of hurting her. Like, I didn't want to hold her feet too tight or move her limbs the wrong way to change the diaper.
Sure.
And I locked up. Like, I ended up just, like, panicking. And I had to step away from the, you know, the crib thing and turn to the nurse and was like, you have to do it. And I just, like, went and stared out a window, just like breathing mm-hmm. and calming myself back down. And I in that moment, I was like, I'm going to be the worst dad. Why can't I do this? Then that night, in the hospital room with my wife, we were watching HGTV. And on one of the shows, there was some dipshit who had kids, and like he had like three kids. And I said out loud, well, if that asshole can do it, I can do it. And so then,
it's
like,
just
I woke
like
up
watching
the next
someone
morning.
Play guitar.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, I woke up the next morning. I was like, I've got this. If he can do it, I can do it. And so, like,
it's great.
Never locked up, changing a diaper again. I mean, it's still been a journey to become the best dad in the world. But now that I'm here, it seems so easy.
You're using your superpowers for good.
That's what I'm trying. My positivity and my like self-confidence I try to use to like share with other people, make other people happy, and you know, share the positivity I give myself every day and project it outward. And like, I try to do good, which I think leads to, sometimes I'll like say on something that I'm a narcissist, or I'll say it on Twitter, and I get this pushback of people like, no, you're not, you're great. And it's like, okay, but like, that's like saying I'm a recovering alcoholic and somebody saying, but I never see you drink. And it's like, yeah,
right,
exactly.
Right.
I actively work at it.
Right. Good for you. That's great. That's great. And listen, I don't think you're that great of a guy. So I think, we're really, like, I'm helping really settle all the stuff that's lifting you back off the ground. Okay.
You balance me out, Janet.
Game.
I've always said that.
I'm the number one balance in your life right now.
Thank you.
Aside from your daughter. Okay. I want to get into this MASH game. I'm very excited about it. I want to start with this first category, which will be give me three fictitious fantasy sci-fi type places that you would like to have a vacation home.
Ooh, okay. I would like to have a vacation home on the forest moon of Endor.
Indeed.
I don't care what anybody says. I love the Ewoks.
Oh my God, me too. I really feel like maybe they're real somewhere.
Yeah. I had an Ewok Village playset. It's one of the greatest things I've ever gotten for Christmas. Oh, that had like best. A little elevator you could like crank, and it had a net in it, and it was like four trees with it. Like, oh, I loved it so much.
I remember it.
So let's see, two more. I would like, man, I wish I could. So, God, this is so dorky. There was a Nickelodeon kids show called David the Gnome. Mm-hmm. And he lived in this like tree thing that had like all these intricate, like, you know, there were traps to keep bad people out and like how their like elevators and plumbing and stuff work. And they did an episode of the show where like he explains how the house was built. And oh. all I wanted to do was go and explore it.
Yeah. Okay. So this is an interesting theme. What if your third one, if you were like, and the tree that the Keebler elves live in?
Oh, man, that would also be cool. The other one would be, you know, I'm trying to think of something else that, you know, I love and is dorky, but there's, let me think. Where would I want to go? Where would I want to? I'm looking around my room at all of my dorky toys. Oh,
that might
you know
help.
What?
It might help.
Krypton. I have a great poster from the 70s on my wall that's a map of Krypton, and it shows nice. All the different like locations of Krypton, and I've always been fascinated by it.
That's a great one, because when I think about Krypton, I just think about the very first Christopher Reeve Superman movie, mm-hmm. and it just seems like a terrifying place, because it was like, as a child especially, when things are like shaking, the camera's shaking to show that the mm-hmm. planet's cracking up and everything, and everyone's like scared and like it's very Titanic-ish in attitude. I was like, this place is awful. It's terrifying. But of course, that's just what happens when your beautiful place crumbles.
Well, that's the thing. It's all crystalline and beautiful, and oh, it's great.
That's fantastic. Okay, great. Next category is three foods that in this reality are, you know, not great for you to have every day. Maybe you're allergic to them. Maybe they would give you diabetes. Maybe, you know, mm-hmm. they're fattening, whatever. But in this alternate reality we're creating, they are, in fact, good for you. And you can have them at the snap of your finger. It can be something rare that you can't get to because it's far away, whatever. But three things that you can have in perpetuity without it negatively impacting you at all.
Oh, this is easy. Fried chicken is my favorite food in the entire world.
I know if cheesecake isn't on this list, I don't know what.
No, cheesecake is 100%. I will sit and eat an entire cheesecake in a sitting. I've done it before, and I'll do it again. To the point where I taught myself how to make cheesecake so that I could just eat it whenever I wanted to.
Nice.
Yeah, cheesecake's amazing. And then just like boxes of chocolates. Like any like I love chocolate, I love candy, and there's something about getting that candy out of a box that's so much fun to me. Oh, I love it.
I couldn't agree more. See's candy boxes were a staple every Christmas, so I associate it so positive. I in my deepest core also associate boxed candy with like being given other presents and like eating other like Ooh. Everything about it is
sorry you broke
wrapped
up really
up
bad. What did you
like,
say?
Oh, sorry. I was just saying that See's candy we would get every Christmas at my grandparents. Yeah. So it's like it not even just the enjoyment of the candy. It's now like hardwired to my thoughts of Christmas and getting other presents and just like the happiest memories you could possibly have. So boxed chocolates, I couldn't agree more.
Well, you know, for me, wonderful. I have this really bad habit of like flexing my adulthood where like I'll see a box of chocolates on like the drugstore shelf and think, you know what? I'm an adult. I buy that if I want to. No one's going to tell me I can't do it. And so, like, I'll just come home with a box of chocolate. My wife is like, why did you buy? We have so much candy in the closet. I'm like, because I'm an adult and I can.
Amazing. Okay, listen. Speaking of your amazing wife, because I do need to get this category out of the way. I always feel really guilty about it. This is three alternate universe. It could just be like sexy times. It could be like kind of friendship, love, alternate universe, mm-hmm. relationship times. It could be people from like people you know, like famous people you had a crush on when you were a teenager, anybody from any era, any age. It could even be fictitious characters. Three.
Oh, okay. Let me see. I had a massive crush on Tara Lipinski. who was a figure skater in, I think maybe the 98 Olympics. She was on the cover of a TV guide that we had, and I just thought she was like the cutest. And it was age appropriate at the time, I should say. I think I was,
and
like,
she was an Olympian, so you felt like she was up to your standards.
Yeah, exactly. But I just thought she was so cute. I was like 14, 15, which I will also say, as long as I'm saying weird crushes I had, Andie McDowell. When I was a kid, ooh, I had a huge crush on Andie McDowell.
Okay. Was there a movie that really did that for you?
I think it was either Michael or Groundhog Day. I just thought she was like, and not in like a, not in any way like I want to have sex with that person kind of crush, but honestly, like, yeah, there was just like, she just seemed so great. Like, and yeah, cute, and I think I was, like, 12, and, like, you know, that age where I wouldn't have thought about sex so much, it was just like, right, I want to hold her hand.
Right.
And then, let's see, a fictitious, I'm trying to throw, I don't know if I, this seems a little obvious, a little easy, but I am just crazy about that Beyonce Knowles.
Oh, hell yeah.
I remember, one, being a fan of her long before this, but her in Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me, there was just something about it where it was like, well, that's the most beautiful woman in the world. And like,
yeah,
I'm both a huge fan of her work. I like her whole persona, and I think she's incredibly beautiful. And mostly, I would just love to sit and like, ask her questions and let her talk to me. Ooh, can I throw one more in? Because now I've just remembered it.
Oh, a bonus, eh?
Bonus.
This is very, this is never done.
I just remembered this in the same way of like, I just want to sit there. Regina Spektor.
Agreed.
I saw her, big fan, and I saw her live in concert. And I would just like to sit in a room while she plays piano. Like, and sings. Like, I would just sit there for hours and hours and hours and hours. I think she has a great energy when she's playing. I love her style of music. I love her voice.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
And she just, when I saw her perform, she was sick. And she, like, said in the microphone, like, hey, I'm, like, super sick, but I didn't want to cancel the show. So here we go. And like, she still was amazing. And then she would finish the song and just like lean into the microphone and say a really quiet, sick, like, thank you. And then start the next song. Aww. And it was just like the most like sweet, like, I just want to get to know you. You seem so nice and pleasant.
Yes.
Yeah. So
that's those fantastic. Would be mine. Agreed. Oh, she's a class act. Okay, next category is, let's do three modes of transportation that are kind of sci-fi or otherworldly, or have not yet been made possible for us as humans, that you would use to get around.
Okay, so speeder bike, from the Star Wars, which now I'm worried that I'm not saying the right thing, but that, a TARDIS, TARDIS. I love the idea of a moving house. Like, that has always got me. That idea of, like, all my shit's still here is so convenient.
Hell yeah. Hell yes.
I have also, Janet, I'll tell you my dream.
Tell me your dream.
I want angel wings so badly. So badly. I sometimes just picture it, and then I have to remember that it's not real. Just these like 12-foot wingspan, glorious white angel wings. Once again, I think this might be part of narcissism, that I want just glorious angel wings. But like, I've always envisioned, this is the scene, in a bar, kind of a seedy dive bar on the outskirts of town. Mm-hmm. I'm just sitting there quietly having a drink, and some big roughneck tries to start a fight with me. And I'm like, you don't want to do this. And he's like, what are you? Oh, I'm supposed to be afraid. And then I just like flex, and these like huge wings pop out of my back. And like, everybody stumbles back, and they're just like, my God, an angel. And like, and nobody wants to fight an angel. That's the scene as I see it play out in my mind.
I love it. And does that mean that you're like an X-Men fan? And is that character named Angel? Oh, am I crazy?
I believe he became Archangel. Yeah, he started as Angel. Yeah, I just love that. I love the idea of just like both. I think Wolverine's claws, I feel the same way about. But this idea of just like getting ready for a fight, and you know, like something springing from your body.
I couldn't agree more.
So like,
You know what? There needs to be a word for that. The act of a supernatural weapon that is inside of you springing to attention before a battle. There needs to be a word in our vocabulary for that. It's the word you would use for Wolverine. It's claws coming out. It's a word you would use for the wings coming out. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Get on that.
That idea of like, you also see it sometimes with Nightcrawler where it's like, suddenly you'll just like see his tail like up over his shoulder, and like just that kind of, I think it's the idea of like just another kind of ambulatory body part that's like, this is gonna help me in a fight. There's something about that that's just so cool to me.
I love it. I love that you helped me identify that, how specific that is, and that it's absolutely true.
It's also a thing that happens with Human Torch, where like he'll be sitting there and just like his hand, like he'll make his fist like go on fire. Something about that like preparing for battle and like girding yourself with your weapons and armor is so cool to me.
It's almost like it's the external expression of an adrenaline rush.
I love it.
Okay, now all this talk about superheroes makes me want to ask three superheroes that could be your buddy.
I have always been fascinated by the idea of Green Lantern, no matter which Green Lantern we're talking about. The idea of like using your will to shape energy. It's just incredible. But I think especially Kyle Rayner was my favorite because Kyle Rayner had like kind of a graphic artist sensibility when he would create stuff. So that was very fun. Yeah. I think I'd be friends with Booster Gold. Once again, narcissist. I think that we would just get along really well.
Great.
And, there was also, I'm trying to remember his, I'm so mad at myself now, because now I can just think cat, and I can't remember what the first word is. It was a boxer. Oh, no, take it back. That's out. Someone will tweet at me and tell me what that is. Starman, but the Starman that was the son of the original Starman, he was this, like, you know, kind of leather jacket wearing guy who used like a staff instead of like a rod. And it was like really beautifully constructed graphic novels, very much in like the vein of like Sandman. Like a cigarette smoking, like, you know, World War II goggle wearing, leather jacketed kind of dude. And he was like, didn't want to be a superhero, but had to because, like, his dad did it and his brother did it. And, like, it was a really great character.
Yeah,
it was so cool. Yeah, that's it.
Okay, so that Starman. I put Starman, but we know the Starman of which you speak now because we've had the explanation. Okay, then three. Now, this one is just three regular skills. They could be extraordinary in the sense that it could be, like, martial arts or you can speak, you know, three languages. But three attainable if difficult to perfect skills that you can kind of download Matrix style and wake up with overnight and in the morning be like, I know Kung Fu.
One, encyclopedic knowledge of like diseases, injuries. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. Like my sister-in-law is a doctor who is fascinated by like infectious diseases. So like she just, doctors who like really are on point and like know their stuff seem like wizards to me, of this ability of like, I'm able to hold all of these facts and terms and things in my head, seems like magic. Gymnastics, I would say, like that idea of like swinging, and I mean like actually like, you know, the walking on the bar and pommel horse and like parallel and uneven bar, all of the flipping around is like, oh, okay, that's a superpower to me as far as I'm concerned. I've gone to a couple like meets, you know, like gymnastic meets, because I had a friend in college who did it, and it was like, watching superhumans flip around. It was incredible. And then I wish I was really good at like bow and arrow. I think that would be a fun, not to hunt. I have zero interest in actually ever injuring any animals whatsoever. But like as a archery competition kind of thing, it seems like such a cool, archaic skill.
Yes.
That like I wish I was just instantly great at.
Yes. Okay, awesome. Awesome. Okay, three movies that you can jump into and hang out with the characters. You're not reinventing, you know, you're not reliving the plot. It's just a world that you can kind of go into. It's and then you can kind of be with the characters and stuff, but nothing bad can happen to you.
Well, it's not a great answer, but my favorite movie in the world is Blazing Saddles. So I would love to hang out with Bart and Jim, who is my favorite buddy duo in pretty much any comedy ever.
Yeah, so good.
And then Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I would like to be friends with Ferris Bueller.
Mm-hmm.
I was obsessed with that movie when I was in high school because I was a
You sound like you were a bit of a Ferris.
Oh, I wanted to be so bad. So bad. So bad I wanted to be. I'm torn between my actual answer or a cool guy answer. The actual answer would be another movie I was obsessed with when it came out. The original Pirates of the Caribbean. I saw 9 times in theaters. I loved it so much. My cool guy answer would have been like, oh, I want the Wet Hot American Summer. But really, I would be on a pirate ship.
No, pirates. We all value and salute your honesty for sure.
Listen, it hurts. It's giving away a lot of myself.
But, it's worth it because, listen, if you end up with that, you're going to be so glad that you said something authentic.
Right.
Okay, and then final category is three... Let's do three TV families that were like alternate universe families that you grew up in.
Ooh, okay. Like that I relate to on my own, or like if I had...
Whatever you think would be fun.
Okay. I really, really liked the family on Step by Step.
Great.
Because I liked I liked the idea of like the two families coming together and building a new family. It was very Brady Bunch, but in a much more snarky, sarcastic way.
Right.
So I really liked them. Also, Boy Meets World. I loved the Matthews with their magical disappearing daughter. Yep. She went away for a couple seasons and came back and was a different actor. But that the core, like, the parents, Mr. and Mrs. Matthews, whose first names are now escaping me, were just like the classic, like, I'm going to like sit you down and give you the perfect thing to say.
Right.
And man, I think I'm just sticking with all TGIF here, but Family Matters was also like, I loved Carl Winslow so much. Like they did such a good job of making Carl funny, but an amazing dad. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's so easy to write a bad dad to make him funny.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But Carl Winslow was a great dad who they also made funny. And, like, I think a lot of
That's
that comes
great
from, like...
observation.
Well, Reginald Val Johnson is also an incredible actor. But,
he's so amazing.
There are so many great moments of Carl dealing with like real world issues in a way, like, just do the most cursory YouTube search and you will find all kinds of great scenes of like addressing like his son being treated differently because he's black, or like a teacher who doesn't respect Laura, or his boss being shitty, like these real world problems and addressing it in this way that you just want to like stand up and clap and like
I love it.
Carl Winslow, big fan.
Carl Winslow. Okay, awesome. That's so good. God, that's also true about that writing. Okay. So now I just have to do my little squiggle where, you know, you tell me when to stop, and then that's the kind of number I use to do my eeny, meeny-ing.
Okay.
So just tell me when to stop.
Okay. Stop.
Okay. I'm going to pause. You pause too. And then I'll just do this real quick. I'll come back with your 100% guaranteed MASH future. Okay. Listen, first of all, this was very unprecedented because I threw in that bonus, Regina. And so it really reshuffled what the number I think normally would have resulted in. And I'm very pleased with the results. I can't say that she didn't end up being the gal, but I feel like we can kind of thank her for a couple of key things that I'm really excited about. So I'm going to start out by telling you that, you know, mansion, apartment, shack, or house, that's a little confusing. It's not under our control. But because you picked such specific kind of home type places that you would be, the fact that you got a shack seems kind of fine because you're in the David, like the gnome tree, which is like, oh, who perfect. Cares? It's the tree. It doesn't matter. Like, it is what it is. Yeah. It's its own thing. So,
Sounds great.
So you have that. It is filled with unlimited boxes of chocolates.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. You can get to and from it on your speeder bike.
Okay.
You can, when you're tired of that or you want to go in and visit your alternate universe family, you can hang out with the family of Matters. Carl is your alternate universe dad. I know. Super psyched about
that. I'll never let Urkel in my tree. I want to stress that. Stefan Urkel, welcome anytime.
Yeah, you're taking this assignment very seriously, and I really respect that. You also are buddies with Booster Gold.
Mm-hmm.
Who
sounds about right.
May or may not enjoy jumping into Pirates of the Caribbean with you.
Probably would.
And I know one of the reasons that you were able to win Beyonce's heart was your wizard-like ability to diagnose kind of diseases, infectious diseases, injuries, etc.
I heard that's why she's with Jay-Z.
That's right. That's exactly right. A lot of people don't know that. A lot of people don't know that. And that, my friend, concludes your MASH future. I think you really set yourself up for a spectacular success there. You made such great choices.
That's a great life.
It's a kick-ass alternate universe life.
I'm super pleased with how this all went down.
Yeah. The only way I can see the end of this podcast going better is you singing a snippet of Don Henley's Boys of Summer for me as we end our podcast together. And thank you so much for doing this, Travis.
You're welcome. Let me think where to start. After the boys of summer have gone. And that's all. I'm trying to remember anything. I also know the line, you got your hair pulled back and your sunglasses on, baby. I can see you. Your bronze skin shining in the sun. After the boys of summer have gone.
Okay, that was amazing because you kind of did a remix where you put things out of order, but it almost sounded better than the real version. So that's
I just put together like the little bit I remember. Yeah.
That's great. You cobbled it all together and it sounded flawless. So fantastic. That does it for this episode. Thanks again, Travis. Guys, thank you for listening. And I will talk to you next time on the podcast. As always, the JV Club theme song is Back Before We Were Brittle by the amazing Say Hi.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.